Hi, my name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health, and I have the one, the only Dr. Larry Lipschultz here with me today.
You do. So I don't have to introduce myself.
Can you give a little bit more of an introduction for the audience?
Okay, so I'm Dr. Larry Lipschultz. I'm professor of urology, Baylor College of Medicine.
Mic drop. That was awesome.
Okay.
So we are at the American Urological Association meeting in Las Vegas, and your research group has 10 abstracts being
We
presented.
do. We do.
Now you've been doing, you're like, the godfather of andrology.
Well,
How do you keep coming up with research questions after all these years?
I mean, I think the more you do and the more you see patients in this area, the more questions you know and you find that don't have answers. And the lack of answers initiates research. So that's kind of how we come up with the projects.
Yeah. So as you're seeing patients, you realize what questions need to be answered, and then you answer those questions, and then more, it's
Yes.
all
Yes.
your
It's
patients
a
are still
vicious
coming in.
cycle. It's a vicious cycle.
So we're going to talk
Plus,
about,
I think it's really important that I do have a fellowship. And one of the things that I like when I hire fellows is someone who's got intellectual curiosity. So they kind of help the process develop as we come up with questions. They're the ones who actually go and do the dirty work and finding the data.
Well, actually, that brings us into a good point, which is as you're interviewing applicants, how do you assess someone's curiosity?
Well, I mean, I think it's primarily their personality. I can tell from someone's personality
How?
whether they're curious
Yes.
intellectually, whether they're just curious about science. So it's more a question. It's not a me asking them, well, what are you interested in? It's more a kind of a sense of what they're doing and also what they want to do with their life. I would say half of my fellows end up in academics, but another half do end up in private practice. So even private practice urologists, when they're fellows, do have that same intellectual curiosity, or they're not going to be part of the program.
But what questions are you asking? Is it looking at their CV and asking what research have you done, or how are you teasing that curiosity out?
You know, I never thought about it, but I guess it's primarily discussing topics related to what we do and seeing what kind of questions they ask. And I think then I get kind of a gestalt. Is this somebody who's going to be productive? And not only clinically, but in the laboratory as well. And the laboratory now has become more clinical research than it is the wet lab. But we do have fellows, for instance, this year, who are working on exciting areas of research that do not require them going to the basic laboratory.
So what are some of the areas of research that you're working on that really excites you?
So I think there's two general areas. One is there's a real problem in reproductive medicine, as you well know, is men who have no sperm, lack of sperm in the ejaculate, azoospermia. And many of these men have what we call non-obstructive azoospermia. So it's a problem of testis making sperm, and maybe the sperm can't get out. But in such low numbers, you're not really considered obstructed. So how do we know if an individual has sperm in the testis and would be candidates for surgery? So we are now working on projects to see whether we can predict sperm in the testicle. So I have one fellow who is working on, and a shout out to Taylor Cohn,
Shout out Taylor
Taylor
Cohn,
Cohn,
raise the roof.
right, who's working on the use of very high resolution ultrasound to actually identify tubules in the testicle that have sperm versus ones that don't. And he's going to be presenting that data in an hour. And then there's the second fellow with me.
And so really quick, so you're using that technology as you're harvesting sperm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But he did work before in animals. He has done basic research when he was at Hopkins that kind of paved the way to now go to the patient. My other fellow is there's also patients who have very, very few sperm in the ejaculate. It's called cryptospermia. And the way we look at these patients is we take their sample, we put
I've
it
never
in.
heard that term.
Really? So, well, now you have. So they take these samples, you take these samples, put them in a centrifuge, spin them down, and look at the pellet. It's called a pellet analysis. So we can find sperm in a man who's been told he has no sperm, we can find sperm. Those sperm can be used to put into his wife's eggs, okay, by our IVF colleagues. But we're now finding that there's patients who have sperm in such few numbers that we can't even find them on the pellet analysis. So there are some groups that are doing extended search where they spend up to 8 hours looking, looking at these pellets.
Praise the people who are doing the 8 hours.
I know. Well, they're getting paid, I'm sure. But what my fellow Blair Stocks is doing, he's now junior faculty, actually.
I met him yesterday.
Yes,
actually.
Great, great person. He is, shout out to Blair.
Shout out, raise the roof to Blair.
He is using a technique where he's using a flow cytometer type of machine that can also fluorescently tag sperm, where he can do what took these extended search doctors 8 hours, he can do in 10 or 15 minutes.
Wow.
I know, unbelievable. Last week, he ran 30 samples that were all labeled azoospermic. No sperm, not even on a pellet. 50% had sperm.
Wow.
So those men who were told they could not have children now have the potential of having children.
Wow.
I know, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and it's all tied into new technology, the use of AI to help with these searches. So those are the two really exciting areas right now.
Wow, I love that. And then, you know, the third topic that I'm very much fascinated by, and we've spoken about this before, is the men who are interested in fertility,
right,
who are on testosterone,
right,
and instead of just taking them off and saying you're going to suffer a little bit to have a baby, right, is you're keeping some of these guys on testosterone and you're adding FSH and HCG.
We are.
To improve their sperm parameters.
We are.
Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, what testosterone does is turn off the stimulatory hormones for sperm production, FSH and LH, from the pituitary gland.
Yeah.
So it only makes sense if we give these back to the individual, then we can still give them testosterone. So we started by stopping testosterone, showing that we could stimulate sperm production in these individuals with the use of exogenous LH in the form of HCG and pure FSH. Once we established that, then we added back the testosterone and said, okay, don't stop it. Stay on your testosterone because it only seems logical. Why do you have to stop it if we're giving it to them?
Yeah.
And the mechanism by which it was bad was by stopping these hormones. And it's working fine.
Yeah. Now, I could see how some people might be concerned that if you have them on all those medications, what are the side effects?
There are very few side effects because these are naturally occurring hormones. I mean, we're just giving the man back the hormones that he normally produces, but now temporarily he's not.
Yeah.
You know, but they don't have to stay on it long term. It's just until their wife gets pregnant. Amazing. But I think an important thing to bring up about this population is if you look at the literature, a lot of the literature says X percentage don't come back. They don't make sperm again. But what they're not doing is testing men before they go on testosterone to see if they're in that group that don't have sperm. So now anybody who goes on testosterone at our facility gets a semen analysis. So we now know, is this an individual who we expect to come back to fairly normal levels?
So these are men who might be interested in future fertility.
Oh, they all are. The ones that we test are men who are going to have in the reproductive age years.
Okay. Well, you've certainly been busy at this meeting. So I'm looking at AUA 2026.
Yes.
So you're going to have to start preparing for your 10 abstracts, you know, right now.
We've started.
You've started.
Yes. We're generating data in the past couple months that we couldn't get to this meeting, which will be hopefully. But, you know, when you submit, it doesn't mean they're going to be accepted.
Right.
It's all done to blind it. So. Yeah. Hopefully, they will take our abstracts.
So what questions are you looking to answer next on your web show?
I don't even want to discuss it. It's proprietary at this point, right? Some things stay in Las Vegas, right?
Absolutely. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Right. Well, we're not going to share that
information. We can't share it.
So you'll just have to stay tuned to AUA.
It's very exciting, right?
I love it.
I love
it. Dr. Lipschultz, it is always a pleasure.
And it's so good always seeing you.
Thank you. That was lovely.